This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Lindsay Addario, had been a photojournalist working in war zones for 10 years when she was kidnapped in Libya in 2011 while covering the fighting between Muammar Gaddafi's troops and rebel forces. She was with Anthony Shadid, Tyler Hicks, and Stephen Farrell. They were all on assignment for the New York Times. It was a terrifying experience, yet Addario says she's been lucky. In her new memoir, she writes, quote, "I have been kidnapped twice. I have gotten in one serious car accident. Two of my drivers have died while working for me. Two tragedies I will always feel responsible for. I have missed the births of my sister's children, the weddings of friends, the funerals of loved ones. I have disappeared on countless boyfriends and had just as many disappear on me." Unquote. She writes about her work as a conflict photographer in such places as Afghanistan, Iraq, and Congo, and about its impact on her personal life. Her memoir is called It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. Addario spoke with Terry last Wednesday.
Lindsay Addario, welcome to Fresh Air. Right before you were kidnapped in Libya, you were thinking it's time to get out of the area you were in. It had just become too dangerous. You were having premonitions before the road trip that you were taking. And during that trip, the trip that you got kidnapped on, you and three fellow journalists, you kept thinking you should turn back. But you didn't want to say that because the three journalists you were traveling with were men. And you didn't want to be the cowardly photographer or the terrified girl who prevented the men from doing their work. You'd certainly already proven your bravery. Can you describe what was going through your mind about being a woman and not wanting to say something?
Sure. First of all, I had been covering the front line for at least 2 weeks at that point, and I was exhausted. And the fighting was incredibly intense, and there was no cover on the front line. So basically, when you went forward as a photographer or as a journalist, there was nowhere to hide, and you were bombarded all day, every day. And so a few days, either the day before or a few days before we were taken, I had a feeling something was going to happen. And I actually went to my friend Brian Denton, who was another photographer, and I handed him a hard drive of all of my images from Libya that I had shot to date. And I said, if anything happens to me, please FedEx this to my photo agency, and if nothing else, at least my images will be salvaged. And then the next day or 2 days later, we were taken. And so that morning, you know, sometimes when you cover war, you just wake up scared, or I do, and sometimes I feel fearless. And so on that particular morning that we were taken, Tyler and I were alone in Ajdabiya. We had stayed overnight in this house that the New York Times rented, and we were waiting for our colleagues to join us. And we had a kind of relaxing morning, and then we went out to start working. And I just was scared that day. I can't really describe it. I was kind of paralyzed by my own fear, and the fighting was coming closer and closer. And we all knew that we had a feeling that the city would fall, that Ajdabiya was going to fall that day. And a lot of the journalists started pulling out. And we were in two separate cars. Tyler and I were in one car, and Anthony Shadid and Steve Farrell were in another. And at some point throughout the morning, Steve and Anthony's driver just pulled over to the side of the road and dumped their stuff on the road and said, I'm leaving. My brother has been shot up at the front line. And so they ended up coming in our car. And there were four of us in one car. And it's very difficult to have four journalists in one vehicle because we all have very different ideas of how long it's safe to stay. We just have different needs also. I mean, I as a photographer will have very different needs from Anthony, who was a journalist, and he needed interviews and I needed photos and Tyler needed photos. And so at some point, it was clear that we had different opinions. And in those moments, I'm very aware of my gender, and I'm sure my colleagues were not. I'm sure the last thing they were thinking of is, oh, we've got a girl in the car. But I always was, because it's such a man's world that I work in. And so I was ready to leave, and I didn't want to say anything. And at one point, Steve Farrell said, look, I think we should go. And I was like, yeah, I think so too. But Anthony and Tyler still were working. And so then I was like, well, I might as well work if we're here. So we just kept kind of working. And eventually, finally, we decided to pull back. But at that point, it was too late.
So you said before that when you thought, you know, when you had your premonitions and you thought this might be the end and you might be killed in Libya, you gave your hard drive to another journalist and said, in case I don't make it, get these photos to my editor. Uh-huh. And it made me think about when you risk your life on a regular basis, as you have done in war zones, when you really think this may be the end, how important is your work, the work that you've actually risked your life for? You know, when you hand your hard drive over to someone and say, make sure my editor gets this, does your work still seem really important when you think that this might be the last day you're alive?
Well, it kind of seems like the last thing I have. It seems like, yeah, of course, my work, I always think my work is important or I wouldn't risk my life for it. But I also feel like in those moments, if nothing else, my work will stand. And even if I am no longer here, here is this body of work I've created, and I hope that that endures. And so that was something that was important to me. I remember the moment in which we were taken hostage in Libya, and we were asked to lie face down on the ground, and they started putting our arms behind our backs and started tying us up. And we were each begging for our lives because they were deciding whether to execute us, and they had guns to our heads. And I remember thinking, God, what am I doing here? Like, how much do I really care about Libya? And then I thought, will I ever get my cameras back? I mean, which is the most ridiculous thought, of course, when you're about to die. Who cares if I get my cameras back? But, you know, for me, that was how my brain worked.
So, you know, there's one moment that you described during your kidnapping that I actually thought was, like, kind of funny. And so you're kidnapped with three men, three male journalists. At this point, you're in a room together. And you're right, the men took turns urinating in the bottle in the corner. And I longed for a funnel or a penis. I thought that was hysterical. And I think every woman has been through a moment where they realize, like, a woman's anatomy is so relatively inconvenient at certain times compared to a man's. And it's something I actually often wonder about when reporting from war zones or when getting held hostage or something like that. How do you – you don't have to describe it, but, I mean, like, how do you deal with that? You know, was that something that, sure, that really bothered you, or was that just like something you thought about for a second and, you know?
Well, I mean, I was very conscious of it because I didn't want to have to go to the bathroom because as the only woman, I didn't want to be separated from the men. But it was very interesting, and I didn't write about this in the book, but in the first few moments after we were taken and we were I talked about the moment where they tied me up and carried me away. Well, they ended up sitting me in a car on the front line, and they sat four of us. So Steve and I were put in one car, and Anthony and Tyler were put in the other. And they literally parked the cars in the middle of the road that was being bombarded. It was the front line. So we were tied up and just put on the front line and watched bombs and bullets and everything rain around us. And at some point, I had to go to the bathroom, and I asked one of the soldiers if I could go to the bathroom. And I was about to go off on my own, and Anthony ran over to me and said, no, I'm coming with you. And it was so smart of him to realize that I should not go on my own. And I will forever be grateful to him. May he rest in peace. But I remember I ran off, and he would not leave my side. And he came, and he stood outside of the door. They took me to this kind of weird police station that was nearby where they were holding us at that point. And he just stood outside the door and would not leave me. And then after that, I basically just didn't drink any fluids or eat anything. I had a few sips of a juice box or something because I didn't want to have to go to the bathroom because honestly, in those moments, it's the most inconvenient thing. It's like you don't I wasn't hungry because you kind of, you know, your body just shuts down in that very traumatic moment. But I didn't want to have to go to the bathroom. So Luckily, the next time I went, we had stopped at some security office, and I asked to use the toilet there. And so there were a few moments, like there were a few times throughout the first few days where I was able to find a toilet, which was a miracle. But when we were sitting in that prison cell, I just thought, oh, this really sucks. You know, this is really difficult because I'm the only woman. Like, I'm not going to sit there in front of three of my colleagues, you know. So that's what happened.
What promises did you make to yourself if you survived?
Well, I thought about starting a family. That was definitely one thing that I thought of and I said out loud when we were in prison. I'm married to Paul DeBender, who was a journalist for Reuters for 16 years. And he had always wanted a family, and I kept saying, no, no, I'm not ready. My career, I'm not ready. And I was 37 at that point, and I did say, look, if I survive this, maybe I should seriously think about having a family. And I did get pregnant about a month after we were released.
So of the reporters you were kidnapped in Libya with, Steve Farrell gave up reporting from war zones. Photojournalist Tyler Hicks went back to his work and has since done some, you know, extraordinary work, including his pictures inside the mall in Nairobi, Kenya, when it was taken over by terrorists. Anthony Shadid afterwards snuck into Syria to report on the civil war, and he died of an extreme asthma attack while trying to leave Syria. How did you decide what you wanted to do, whether return to war zones or give that up?
Well, there was never a question in my mind as to whether I would give it up. I didn't think I would stop going. I just thought I had to figure out how to modify how I would cover war because I didn't want, first of all, I've now been kidnapped twice, and I think once you get to the point where you've been kidnapped three times, one almost looks irresponsible, and I didn't want to put my family through that. Obviously, I now have a son. So I wanted to continue doing my work, but I had to figure out how. And so what I have basically come up with is that I still go to Afghanistan and Iraq and South Sudan and many of these places that are rife with war, but I don't go directly to the front line. I try to stay back. I try and cover civilians. I try and cover refugees. So I'm trying to cover the issues and humanitarian crises, but without putting myself directly in the line of fire. Obviously, with ISIS, that becomes more difficult because there is no distinct front line. I mean, people can get kidnapped from cities or it can happen in Paris. So it becomes much more difficult to navigate that. But I think that's across the board for every journalist.
You quote the great photojournalist Robert Capa as having once said, if your pictures aren't good enough, you're not close enough. Of course, in war, the closer you get, the greater the risk you're taking. Can you give us an example of a time you took a great risk to get really close, to get the great photograph, and you felt like it paid off, like you got a really great photograph as a result of getting close and taking that risk?
Well, so I think that quote, there are two ways to read into that, and I always read into it more in not only physically close, but emotionally close. And I think as a photographer, it's very important to get emotionally close to your subjects and to really just break down those walls that exist between a photographer and anyone, because the minute you introduce a camera into any scene, people become aware of that and they become uncomfortable or a bit rigid. And so it's only with time and with feeling comfortable with someone that that goes away. And so a lot of the stories, like I would say in the Korangal Valley in Afghanistan, correspondent Elizabeth Rubin and I spent up to 2 months living with the troops, the 173rd Airborne Battle Company on the side of the mountain. And it was the Korangal Outpost. And we went on patrols with them every day. We hung out with them in the downtime. We really got to know them. And at the end of that embed, we went on a battalion-wide mission operation called Operation Rock Avalanche. And at the end of that operation, we were ambushed by the Taliban from three sides. And three soldiers were shot, and Sergeant Rugel was killed. And it is an extremely sensitive moment for soldiers to have a photographer around when one of their comrades has been killed. And I remember photographing Sergeant Rice and Vandenberg, who were the two wounded, walking to the medevac, and I was photographing them and asking their permission, naturally, and they said yes. And when I went back to photograph the body, Rugel's body, I asked the soldiers who were carrying his body, it was Clenard and Liskey, and I asked their permission, and everyone was crying, and I was crying, and they were crying, and they said yes. And I think that was one of those moments where I was close enough because I'd put the time in and I cared and they felt comfortable with me being there. And I'm not sure that would have happened had I just sort of showed up a few days before.
So when you're shooting in a situation like that, you've been ambushed from three sides by the Taliban. Soldiers that you're with are getting shot, wounded, killed, and you're taking their pictures. The things that most photographers want to control, the lighting, the framing, the angle, that's all, I imagine, very different when you've been under fire, when you're photographing people who are, you know, perhaps mortally wounded. What goes into how you take a photo in a situation like that?
Sure. I remember the first few times I was in a gun battle, and I actually forgot to photograph. I was so terrified. All I could think about was, how am I going to dig myself into the ground enough that I'm not going to get shot, you know? And I had to say to myself, okay, now start shooting. And finally, in the Korngal Valley, I had been doing it for years, but I still was terrified. And in fact, in the moment that ambush started, I had just climbed up. I had left my cameras on the side of the ridgeline and my helmet, and I had climbed up. We were on sort of a vertical, almost like a 70-degree angle side of the mountain, and I had to go to the bathroom. And so I had climbed up on my hands and knees, basically climbed up the mountain to look for a tree stump, and I got up there, and the bullets started flying, and I was alone. And so I lied down behind this tree stump, and I'm digging myself into it, you know, saying, and then I thought, what if the Taliban comes from behind me and finds me first? You know, what if I'm the one they find? And so then I'm screaming out, Lieutenant Piosa, who was the one that, he was our sort of point of contact for the journalist. And eventually, and everyone was fully, fully engaged. I mean, it was a full-on gun battle. And so eventually I rolled down the mountain. I just lied down flat and just rolled all the way down the mountain. And I stood up and I saw a Stichter, and he said, get behind a tree. And I said, I need my cameras. I need my cameras. And he just looked at me like, you are insane. And so I ran, and there are bullets everywhere. And I ran, and I found my helmet. I picked up my cameras, and I ran and found Elizabeth, and I jumped behind her. And it was funny because there were like six people hiding behind this teeny weeny little tree that was not more than like 4 inches wide. They offered almost zero protection, but it must have been psychological cover. And so everyone was ducked behind this tree. And I remember I looked to my right, and Tim Hetherington, who was killed in Libya, Tim Hetherington was standing up with a video camera just filming as if he were on a walk in the park on a Sunday. And I just thought, what am I doing? I'm the worst photographer on the planet. I still hadn't taken any pictures. And so finally at that point, I thought, okay, I got to start now. And in that moment, we got a call saying that there were men down. And so we ran forward with Piosa and the medics. And at that point, I started shooting. But, you know, it's never... I don't think I'm a very good war photographer at all. I think I'm horrible because I always forget to photograph, and I'm always trying to make sure I stay alive before I do anything else.
I'm certainly not going to criticize you for trying to stay alive while there's bullets coming at you from every direction.
I know, but I look at some of my colleagues, and they're so brave. I remember Joao Silva. I mean, he used to just walk through bullets, you know. There were friends of mine, Jim Noctaway. I mean, some of these guys are just completely fearless, and I'm not that person.
Well but let me just add that, you know, Joao's legs were blown off by an IED.
And, yes, in Afghanistan.
And Jim Noctaway was shot in the shoulder, maybe?
He was shot recently. I don't remember where it was. But he's okay.
I mean, the dangers are real. It's not like
no,
it's just in your
head.
Of course
the dangers are real.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah. So when you pick your head up and you do start shooting, right?
Finally.
How much thought do you give to, well, how am I going to frame the photo? And is the lighting good? What's my angle like?
No. I mean, all of that stuff, I think, sure, I'm thinking about composition, and I'm also thinking about what is the information I need to get in that photo? So it's more of a technical thing. Like, I need to show that there are troops, that there are bullets and guns and, you know, I mean, basic things that I need to add in the photo. But I'm not worried about light because those things are things that you can worry about when you have the luxury of time. For example, when I'm working for National Geographic and I can go out at 4:30 in the morning and wait for the first sunlight or in the late afternoon. But when I'm covering war, it's more about just being there for the moment.
So now that you're married and you have a son, I'm sure your calculation is very different about what kind of risk you're willing to take. What's it like for you to go back and forth now between being in other countries, in dangerous places, not as dangerous as you'd let yourself be in before you were a mother, but still, you know, risky enough. And then you come home and, you know, I'm sure you have like a lovely apartment in London and that you're probably, you know, pretty protective of your son. They're two such separate worlds.
Yeah. I think this profession is always a matter of straddling two separate worlds, and whether it was the same before I had my son, it was always a matter of kind of parachuting into one place and a devastating third world country or some place where there was war everywhere, and then going home to a really nice house and having everything at my disposal. And it never seemed fair to me that some people are born into lives of privilege and some people are born into misery. So for me, it's always been about sort of juggling those two worlds. Now that I have Lucas, of course, I'm incredibly protective of him, and I think more so because I've seen so many children die and I've seen what can happen, and I am ridiculously protective of him. But I try really hard to be present when I'm home and be with him. And when I'm on the road, I try to be very focused on my work and try and work as fast as I can and long days and get home quickly.
Well, Lindsay Addario, thank you for this interview. Thank you for your work, and thank you for the risks that you've taken to do it. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lindsay Addario spoke with Terry last Wednesday. Her new memoir is called It's What I Do. Our next guest, Michael Keaton, is nominated for an Oscar for his starring performance in the film Birdman, which is nominated for 8 other Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director for Alejandro Iñárritu. Birdman is kind of an existential comedy, with Keaton playing an actor named Regan Thompson, who is having a creative and personal identity crisis. Regan had been famous for starring as the superhero Birdman in 3 films. But he gave up that franchise years ago and has been struggling to figure out who he is as an actor and a man. To prove his artistic worth, he's directing and starring on Broadway in his own adaptation of a Raymond Carver story. During rehearsals and previews, he's constantly second-guessing himself. His insecurities, doubts, and self-absorption physically manifest themselves in the form of Birdman, who keeps appearing to Regan and follows him around, badgering him. Terry spoke with Keaton last week, and they began with this scene. Regan has just come off stage after a disastrous preview. He walks into his shabby dressing room, eats from the refrigerator, and talks with his daughter Sam, who's played by Emma Stone.
Dad.
Hey.
Are you okay?
Why?
You seem sort of...
No, I'm good. This is good. You want some?
No.
Okay.
Do you really think you'll be ready for opening tomorrow?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, well, I mean, previews are pretty much a train wreck. We can't seem to get through a performance without a raging fire or a raging on. I'm broke. I'm not sleeping, like, you know, at all. And this play kind of starting to feel like a miniature, deformed version of myself that just keeps following me around and, like, hitting me in the balls with a like a tiny little hammer. I'm sorry, what was the question?
Never mind.
Michael Keaton, welcome to Fresh Air. I love Birdman and I love your performance in it. When I saw the movie, I thought, perfect. Michael Keaton has done 2 Batman films and was famous for that. He must really relate to this character who used to be a superhero and had been famous for that. And then I read or heard you say that you'd never played a character more unlike yourself before. So explain why, even though I thought you'd be resonating so much with the character, you kind of didn't, in spite of your great performance.
Well, you know, I probably should qualify that a little more than when I said it, which was a long time ago. I don't connect to that type of personality. I tend to not have those kind of personality traits, that constant neediness and insecurity and whininess and, you know, me, the narcissism. You know, when you're one of originally 9 children, you know, there's not a ton of room for that. And, you know, I was raised Catholic, so speaking about yourself or talking about yourself too much is not necessarily. And you know, then on the Protestant side of my family, even more so, do you not talk about yourself. So the whole thing of being self-involved took me a long, long time where I thought it was okay to talk about myself. But so it doesn't come to me naturally.
Birdman is in part about acting, about the egos, about all the talk about being truthful on stage. The actor that Edward Norton plays is like 100% authentic on stage, but as his girlfriend points out, he's a fraud in the real world where it counts. And with you, every time something awful or ridiculous happens to your character, like being locked out of the theater in your underwear, it seems to just bring out a deeper, more honest and more emotional performance in the play that your character is performing in within the movie. And you get more and more naked metaphorically and literally as the movie progresses. So the movie's kind of operating on 2 levels. It's kind of mocking actors, but also getting to what makes their work so beautiful and so deeply felt. What did you do to get to the truth of your character, who you've told us is in a lot of ways not like you?
Well, boy, that's about a... Just listening to what you just said is about as well put as I've heard it through all these interviews.
You.
That's about it, and it's true. And you know, listening to you describe it, it really resonates again with me. Thinking about what Alejandro accomplished, and Chivo Emmanuel Lubezki, the cinematographer, and the camera operator, and the crew, and the cast, and what everybody, and the producers, what everyone really pulled off here in 29 days for very little money. And then I kind of retroactively become extremely frightened thinking, what was I thinking? why did I ever think I should do this? And I think maybe really if I would have thought about it too much, it would have been overwhelming, because I actually end up playing kind of 4 different characters in the movie, which really didn't occur to me till we were about a week and a half or 2 weeks in, thank God, if you factor in that I play characters in the play and then an actor who is actually directing other actors, and then I play those actors, and then I play the Birdman character, the actual Birdman, and my alter ego. And day to day and doing the work and getting to that honest point, that's, for me, it's always about, and it always will be as long as I do this, refining and refining and refining and refining the truth. Just telling the truth constantly, being as truthful and honest and raw and real as you can be. And this was just the mecca of that. If I wanted to escape that, if I wanted to kind of be cowardly about it, I guess, and not expose myself to it and kind of maybe phone a little bit of it in. Even if I wanted to, I couldn't have. I chose not to, because I think it was good timing at this point in my life and my career. And I'd like to think I'm a courageous actor anyway. I think that's the thing when it's all over. I hope someone at least says about me that I had a lot of guts and, you know, sometimes you fail. But to go down, you know, to be frightened and to go down that hole and to be as raw as you can be, that's a blessing to me to get that opportunity. You know, I could have failed miserably. People could have laughed at me and, you know, made fun of me for the rest of my life. And honestly, it probably would have hurt my feelings a lot. And then I would have gotten by it and said, well, you know what? Doesn't really matter because I got a big set of balls. So.
One of the really special things about the film is how it's shot and choreographed. There's a scene in which you're taking some food out of the refrigerator after coming off a after coming off a performance in which you'd locked yourself out of the theater and had to walk in your underwear around to the main entrance of the theater in order to get in, then walk down the aisle, do your performance on stage, finish the performance, and then go backstage and have that talk with your daughter. Is that all one take?
No, that
but,
is not all
not one,
one
take.
But,
I mean like one shot.
Yes, I know what you mean. It's no, that is not all one shot,
okay.
But it's only two, like I would say like two and a half really because and you know, you're right. Actually, when I was listening to you explain to the audience how it was shot, even now I keep remembering things and I think about all the details because not only was it all those things you said, going down the hallway, another actor has to enter precisely at a moment, then there might be three people in the hallway, then you go downstairs. It was even things like downstairs, out a doorway into the hallway where I see Edward, then we walk down the sidewalk. It had to be timed perfectly to get to a line exactly when I tossed the coins to the drummer and then timed out so we were dead on the exact word, not just the line, to enter the bar and then went into the bar and did the scene and then that whole scene runs through the bar, and then I go over and I walk back out. Well, the scene you're talking about, I think, was almost that long. So in all those shots, often it was also a cab had to pull up at the right time.
Right.
You know, and all the little details, and he is so detail-oriented. I mean, I can't imagine what it meant in his mind, in his brain, Alejandro's and Chivo's. Also, the actors had to be aware of it. I had to be aware of it. I had to know kind of what was going to happen at all time and at the same time stay right in the moment and stay locked in the character and be cognizant of all of every tiny detail that was happening in every tiny little bit of the frame. At the same time, forget it and just be in the moment and be truthful and just be the character, you know. Man, there's a lot to this movie.
Well, that sounds really hard, but it's very exhilarating to watch. One thing I'm wondering is like if an actor, not you, but another actor, made a mistake. After everybody works so hard to get all of the choreographed motions down with exact timing, with everybody's emotion being truthful and funny and in the moment. But one person made a mistake, so you have to do the whole thing over again. Would people get angry at that one person?
No, never. That's interesting. You would think that would at least happen at some point, but everyone was in the same boat, you know, and it didn't always exactly occur exactly like that. However, sometimes it would. You just go, oh, no, here we go.
Were you ever that one person?
I'm sure I was. I can't remember. You know, for me, it was never about, oh, I hope I make it to the end of the scene, because then you're not really in the scene. For me, it was about moment to moment, you know, second to second, scene to scene, just staying right on the truthfulness and staying in character and just being the person and just living the truth of it. And then we either got through it or we didn't. And when it didn't work, if you let that pull you down, you were, for me anyway, I was kind of done. I mean, you can't afford that. As mentally tired as I got through this movie, you couldn't afford to get angry or let down. Because then it all starts to fall apart. You know, you it's like an athlete. You have to really emotionally and mentally bear down and be really just as tough and say, let's just keep going. And everybody, I think, had that mindset. So it never really got like that. It was more like Alejandro, you know, would get very frustrated, but it was, you know, he knew it was brought on most of it by himself and Chivo because they're perfectionists. And I tend to be perfectionistic too. So that's either a good combination or a bad combination. I don't really know.
So let me mention that scene again where you get locked out of the theater.
Yeah.
You leave your dressing room to have a smoke and accidentally got locked out and you're in your underwear. It's raining out. So you have to walk around Times Square and get back into the theater through the main entrance where the ushers don't even recognize you and don't want to let you in. But anyways, you really did walk across Times Square in your underwear to shoot that scene. Was it all extras who were watching you or were there real people there too?
Real people, because you couldn't, once again, though, I'm sorry, just give me a second here. Every time I hear you just describe things really well, I start to remember things again or realize things that I'm not sure I realized at the time, because as you described all these things, I thought, you know, it was not just the scene, the entire movie, it was, for Regan Thompson, one indignity after another.
You know, and his fly is open half the time, too.
Yes, just horrible. Just getting worse and worse and worse. Now, what's fortunate about all that is I happen to find that stuff really, really funny. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that I think that's a good idea to do that on a large screen and let millions of people watch it, and I think that's a good idea, that's really weird to choose that as an occupation. But I really do think that stuff is really, really funny.
Did you buy special underwear for the scene? It looks like just your regular...
Yeah, I wanted to go.
Regular
and
what, shorts.
You know, and,
yeah.
And immediately
briefs,
as soon
briefs,
as...
Briefs, the briefs, not shorts.
Briefs, yeah. Yes, what they call briefs. And they're pathetic enough, but what really is the beautiful finishing touch is the black socks. That's what really sold me. Just so sad and pathetic. And him trying to hold his dignity up somehow, you know. Just for a second, here's how smart he and Chivo are. And as precise as this movie had to be, it also, you needed to be flexible. Like, there were things coming up that you went, oh, man, how, every day was problem solving. There are certain things you just can't know definitively how to shoot. And one of them was, okay, we'll get extras for a while, and then they're probably going to disappear and get bored, and then they're not, how do you control the extras? Then how do you control the people from coming in? So kind of at the last second, he created that idea of the drummers and the marching band to distract people that way so that we could not get in the way of actually people, you know, messing up the shot.
When you're walking through the crowd, it's like you're power walking, like your arms are kind of pumping back and forth, almost as if like you're literally swimming through the crowd and you need your arms to propel you.
Yes. Here's a practical part of that. I'm a runner, you know, so and a jogger and a hiker and a walker, et cetera. So I still, my wind's pretty good. My legs are pretty strong and I can move. I can still go, you know, for a guy, you know, my age, I can, but you can't really because camera can only go so fast. So you start to invent things. And one of the things I thought was just hold yourself upright kind of and do a strut that'll work for camera, but also look like kind of stupid, not stupid, but yeah. Kind of, you know, kind of like not silly because you can't go silly, but in a way, like kind of hold up his dignity. But in that shot, everyone talks about that stretch. For me, the front part of that, when I get caught in the door and how I was going to play the reality of how do I get out of this jam? And when he walks away, when Regan walks away and try to like, because into this crouch, like maybe if I crouch, no one will notice I'm in my underwear. And then the idea, maybe my favorite little spot in the movie is when he comes in at the theater and picks up the scene and decides to continue playing the scene from the aisle in his underpants and a wig, in his black socks, and you know, the show must go on, and he keeps doing it. And, I mean, that stuff is really, really silly, and at the same time, just totally fits in with this movie. I mean...
And at the same time, your character is giving a great performance when he walks in spite of the underwear and the black socks and all of that.
Yes.
He's totally in the moment and totally authentic in that performance.
Yes, and also, you know, it's building toward the big moment where it took a breakdown for him to find for the play to come together and mm-hmm. him to come together in terms of a performance. It's just when you keep thinking about what he pulled off, and, you know, if you'd have shot this traditionally, it would have been much, 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 much easier to do and not nearly as interesting.
Your character played a superhero called Birdman, and the Birdman character follows him around as his alter ego, and he's always just kind of insulting him and hectoring him and saying, like, why did you, you know, you should have taken the role. You should have, like, played Birdman again, and you should have taken that reality show that you were offered instead of, like, doing this theater stuff. And so,
yeah.
So his alter ego is basically insulting him a good deal of the time. That's your voice, the voice of the Birdman alter ego, right?
Mm. Right, right.
And are you also in the costume, or is that somebody else?
No, that's me. And by the way, same dimensions as the original Batman suit. I'm very proud to say.
You haven't put on any weight.
Well, I did actually early on in this movie. Alejandro would go to lunch with me and look at the plate, look at the waiter, look at me, and stand there and go keep pushing the plate because, you know, the guy's down and out and been, you know, he's out of shape, et cetera, et cetera. So he really wanted that. But anyway, yes, it is me, and also, you know, Alejandro really and I worked on this early on, rehearsing, talking about it. Then we went into rehearsals, then we shot it. And then the post, in terms of getting the voice and getting the character and rewriting all that dialogue or monologue or language, you know, that Birdman comes up with and rewriting it and going back and trying different recordings. Like, he wanted to do it really in a great studio, and then he didn't like the sound of it. It sounded too kind of perfect, so we found a place where the sound wasn't nearly as good, and we even had one where we could hear noise coming in from the window outside. And he's relentless and perfectionistic, and I was, you know, we had wrapped the movie, and he and I continued to work on it and work on it and work on it.
Let's hear a moment of you as the Birdman, and this is his voice kind of like taunting you.
How did we end up here in this dump? You were a movie star, remember?
Okay, there he is, like, insulting you because you're doing theater instead of a superhero movie. So is that a processed version of your voice?
No. How that happened was when I did Batman, the first one, because I'm ridiculously logical, I got to have some reason for truth in the matter. Even if I am playing a guy in a big black rubber suit, I got to believe somewhere, you know, how I got to justify certain things. So, we were doing a scene with Tim, and I said, hey, you know, we're downtown Gotham. I'm, you know, like 4.5 feet from one of the dignitaries in town. And I was looking at the lighting, and I said, this is not believable. You know, the guy's going to say, he's going to hear my voice, he's going to see my mouth and, you know, whatever he can see and go, hey, it's Bruce Wayne, everybody. You know, so I thought, I got to get around this. We got to, like, change my angle or we got to, and Tim thought it was a great idea, so we lit it kind of differently. And I said, I had already thought of creating a very subtle change in his personality when he went from Bruce Wayne to Batman anyway. I kind of did it. A lot of it was cut out, but I did these other things. But just to justify it for me, I said, I got to make at least some voice change, something here that I can at least believe, you know. So I kind of did the shift in the voice at the top of the movie where I kicked the guy into the door when he asked me who I am or what I am or whatever he asked me. And then I continued to use that voice when I was in the Batman thing, just, you know, as a thing. So I was telling the story to Alejandro, and he thought it was tremendous and funny, and he calls Chivo, Emmanuel Lubezki, over, goes, Chivo, listen to this. So we started laughing. He said, oh, my God, you have to do that. That's it. That's what we're going to do. We're going to do a voice for Birdman. So I said, okay. And then the voice changed and changed and changed. It got a little more gravelly and it got more. And he wanted me to go deeper, the voice, and then raspier voice, then more dramatic. Then he'd hear it and would go back like a week later and change it again. But that's really, that was the origin of it. And it became some kind of bastardized version of what the original Batman voice was.
So, you know, you're talking about the voice that you use as Birdman in the film Birdman and comparing that to the voice you used as Batman in your Batman film. So let's hear a short scene from the first Batman in 1989, directed, as you said, by Tim Burton. And this is from early in the movie, and two criminals are on a rooftop. They've just robbed a place. They're looking at their loot. And then you appear as Batman. You fight them off. You repel their bullets with your body armor. You use your Batman grappling hook. And then you dangle one of the muggers off the side of the building, and he's hollering for you to spare him.
Don't kill me. Don't kill me, man. Don't kill me. Don't kill me, man.
I'm not going to kill you. I want you to do me a favor. I want you to tell all your friends about me.
What are you?
I'm Batman.
And as we can hear, Batman has a very stirring theme. And in Birdman, and in Birdman, your character is always imagining that when he's fantasizing the powers that he had as Birdman and wanting those powers, he's fantasizing like his theme music behind him.
Yes, right, which is majestic and symphonic and really,
yeah,
like when he's flying. You mean, yeah, and beautiful actually. It's funny. I was just listening to that score, which is a great score. Great. And when you hear it, it's not that it sounds dated, because it's really good, actually. But you think, oh, I forgot that. It was that kind of score, you know, Danny Elfman.
Yeah.
How about the courage when Alejandro said, I said, hey, you know, because I really liked his score in Babel, and I wanted to know what that instrument was. It sounded like a mandolin. It's actually not. I think it's a Middle Eastern stringed instrument. He told me what it was. That kind of is the base for that. And we were talking about that, and I said, what are you thinking about? You're going to use those guys again? And he said, no, I think I'm going to do drums, only drums. And I go, really? And he goes, yeah. And I'm thinking, yeah, good luck. He's never going to stick to that. This movie's going to need manipulation. It's going to need strings and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Because it's already risky what he's trying. Man, when I saw it and he stuck to it and stuck with just the, I thought, wow, man, this guy's got some guts. This is real. And it works. It works so great. It's crazy.
I agree. I completely agree. But getting back to Batman, how did it feel to be wearing the cape and the tights?
Simultaneously ridiculous to the point where you had to overcome it, and risky, and I guess kind of cool. I'm claustrophobic, so I had to work through that. It ended up working really perfectly for the character. It made me feel real isolated inside there. Couldn't really hear. So that really ended up being a bonus, a plus for me. But once again, you think, oh boy, this is one of those things. This could really go down. This could just be a huge mistake. But if you punk out, or if you go halfway, or if you don't commit to it, or if you get frightened and kind of want to save yourself and not look, you know, that just doesn't work. That's just never going to work. So, not to me anyway. So you commit to it and say, okay, you know, I'm in. Let's make this thing work. And plus, I had the advantage also that the imagery is so strong and powerful. And once I saw that, I went, oh, this, I'm going to work this thing, man. I'm going to work the angles of the suit, the shadows of the suit, the frighteningness of it, the sexiness of it. I'm going to work the hell out of that.
Well, Michael Keaton, thank you so much for this interview, and thank you for your performance in Birdman.
Thank you for having me. It's great.
Michael Keaton spoke with Terry last Monday. Keaton's starring performance in Birdman has been nominated for an Oscar. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.